Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Wendy Xu, a best-selling illustrator, comics artist, designer, and writer based in Brooklyn, New York. She is the creator of the graphic novels Infinity Particle, Tide Song, and the co-creator of Mooncakes. In this conversation, Wendy shares the origins of her passion for art making and storytelling, her way of balancing commercial success with artistic freedom, and she shares some handy advice for those looking to explore the graphic novel medium. In addition to today's conversation, I will be co-facilitating an 8-week online writer's workshop starting in January in just a few weeks, called Embracing the Multidisciplinary Writer. We will be exploring a variety of writing disciplines and holding the space for writers to connect the dots beyond specialization. To learn more, click on the link in the show notes or visit my events page at www.robertkwonghome.com. Hi, Wendy.
Thank you so much
for joining me on this podcast. I'm so excited. And is it like weird to say that I'm a fan of your career trajectory?
You know? No, I mean, as someone who knows me, you know, I don't think that's weird to say. If it was like a stranger, maybe, but like, I was like, no, I know you. You're a friend, you know?
So. Yeah. No, like similar to like I connected with Rowett, I was just like, it's really nice actually to be able to commiserate like years later to be like, remember when, you know, we were meeting at like the potlucks with all the people and we were all just like talking about what we wanted to do. But anyway, maybe a little background. This is how we know each other. So I met you through my partner, Ari, who is chronically online, and I believe met you on like Tumblr or like you all were all a part of a like an online Tumblr social circle, right?
Yeah, we kind of like informally called it Asian Tumblr, but it was just like a handful of people that ran in this like, I guess we were like artsy, like liberal arts majors, liked writing and cartoons and stuff, so we all kind of would talk to each other. I think this predates even when I started my art blog, maybe. I had two different Tumblr accounts, both of which are now inactive, so nobody goes searching for them. One of them I started in like freshman year of college, and then the second one I started, I think, junior year of college. But I think I met Ari and everyone primarily through my personal one, because we would just share like memes and engage in discourse.
Not much has changed, really. And then I think, you know, everyone who is local to New York would manage to like meet up and find each other. And it's really nice to see like parasocial online relationships be able to blossom into genuine relationships that like, I know Ari has had friendships that's from Tumblr that's going on like a decade plus easily, you know?
Yeah, I think I maybe was the first one who was like, well, everybody lives in New York, we should all just like hang out instead of being online. Selfishly it was because I wanted to like go eat things and I wanted other people to like join me to go eat things.
No, you were like the great organizer. You were like, hey, does everyone want to like get together and like throw like a little gathering? I know like many people credit you with like meeting, like we all met someone through you basically, because like we went to one of your like get togethers. So that's kind of how we know each other. And I'm so happy about that. And then in addition to just fun times and discourse, you are also an artist, a storyteller, an illustrator, a writer, published author. Growing up, what were some of your biggest influences in those areas, like comics, animation, whatever?
Definitely manga. When I was a kid, I would hold myself up in the local library, which like shout out to Kelly. She was the teen librarian. But she had a really great manga collection. She curated it so well. And so growing up, reading like Clamp was a huge inspiration. Fuyumi Sorio and Mars, another huge inspiration. I read a lot of shoujo manga. I read whatever manga was there. Unless it was the ones that was like 20 volumes. I think I read like the first 5 volumes of Naruto and then I was like, no, this is too much. But definitely, definitely manga. I remember being in middle school picking up Neil Gaiman's run on Books of Magic, which had been compiled into a trade, and reading that and really loving it and being really struck by all the different art styles that were in this one book. And then when I was a little kid, I would always watch Journey to the West, like the 1986 Chinese Journey to the West, with my grandma and my dad. And I just like, I love that show. I still love it actually, because it's all on YouTube now. And I rewatched it a few years ago. I'm like, this is so camp. Like, it's actually
The first person to have brought this up in like forever, because the kids nowadays don't know, because they've had like 50 bajillion remakes of that story. But that is the most, that is like the iconic magnum opus of Journey to the West.
I still think it's one of the best adaptations. I think I've read most of Arthur Whaley's translation, which is Monkey. It's called Monkey in English. And Whaley, I think, is not so much interested in the actual text, but he is interested in the vibes. And I think he got the vibes right. And then so reading Whaley like next to this series, I'm like, no, he got the vibes right. That was good. And it's like he preserves like the playfulness of the story, like the silliness of it all.
Yeah.
I think at some point I would like to read like a full literary translation, but I don't think there's like one that's very accessible to like non-academics.
I haven't read an English translation of any of that. I was a big fan of Journey to the West and Lady Whitesnake. There was like a classic old TV drama, and that was like what I grew up with before I came to America. So it's making me nostalgic, you talking about it. How did you even watch it? Because I watched it when I was in China, but would you like, is this online or how?
Like as a kid?
Yeah.
I think we had tapes. I think we had tapes or something. I'm not 100% sure, actually. I just know that it was on and like I would watch it with my grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back when like bootleg tapes and DVDs were like the jam for immigrant families.
Yeah. Hell yeah. We definitely had some VCDs. Do you remember VCDs?
Yes.
Yeah. I had like a bunch of like Pokemon bootleg VCDs dubbed in Chinese. And I was exposed to like all the racy parts of Pokemon that they didn't show like American kids. Like, there's definitely some episodes where, like, James from Team Rocket cross-dresses. There was definitely one episode where he had, like, inflatable titties. I was like, that's interesting. Yeah, those were my influences. And then I loved Steven Spielberg's AI. Like, the movie was weirdly influential for me, I think, because Spielberg got so into, like, the world building and the atmosphere and, like, it was, you know, famously a box office flop, but I think it's like a great movie. I think it's very thoughtful. And it made me think. So a good movie makes you think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember watching that movie when I was a kid too, and it was very thought provoking. And it's so funny, like these subjects are still relevant. So these storytellers were onto something. When did you start? Like, have you always drawn since you were like little, or when did you start like doing your own like comic strips and things like that?
I've always made comics since I was a kid. I would make them with my friends. I would just make them on my own. I really liked just like drawing characters. But when I was like 14, 15, I started getting involved in like online writing circles, like RP forums and stuff. So that's how I started writing, like co-writing with people, just like doing a line in a forum post and they would write back and we would just go back and forth.
Fun.
Yeah, so I've always like really loved co-working with people, the first person I fell in love with as a teenager. We wrote like a whole novel together over AOL Instant Messenger, like going back and forth paragraph by paragraph. We pasted it in like a Word doc. I still have it. It's like so special to me now, because I think that's what started my whole like I want to be a serious writer journey. Yeah, because I was like, wait, I wrote a novel. Like, I'm 15 and I wrote a novel. I know a lot of teens write novels, but I was like, well, I'm the first teen I know who has, like, finished writing a novel. I had all these plans as a teen. I was like, we're going to, like, shop this. We're going to get an agent. We're going to get published. We're going to, like, go on Oprah. Like, I had, like, high hopes of being in, like, Oprah's book club, even though, like, I had no idea. I just knew Oprah was, like, important. So I was like, I want to go on Oprah with this. I want to be like a young ingenue. Obviously, that never happened. But like, I had so much love for the process instilled in me then. And I would make comics with scenes from the novel, too. I would adapt those into comics. I just loved working with people. Like, everybody knows that comics is such a collaborative process.
Yeah.
So I think that part of my love for collaboration, and like, even when I'm doing a book on my own, it is a collaborative process. You're working with your editor, you're working with the design team. And so like, I don't know, I really think this, all of this instilled, I was like, wow, I love working on creative projects with people.
Yeah, isn't that the inspiration behind The Place We Once Called Home? I remember reading that many years ago, and I was like, oh, I know this one is like special to Wendy. You can tell, you know.
Thank you. I think, sadly, Catapult is no longer online. I got to re-upload all those comics to my site at some point. Maybe I'll go and do that after we get off this call so other people can read it. Yeah, The Place We Once Called Home. Well, thanks for bringing that up. It is like a really special comic to me. It just makes me so sad, I think, when you lose touch with people.
Yeah.
I really love keeping everybody I've ever been friends with around. So it just like, it makes me really sad when someone who was like so integral to your creative process as a young person is just no longer there. And there's just like a big, I don't know. I think it's also to do with like, you know, you're falling in, like, this is why I write books for young people, right? You're falling in love for the first time. You're experiencing all of these big emotions. I experienced so many big emotions as a teenager.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that is in my work now, but I end up thinking about that time a lot when I'm making these characters, when I'm writing these situations.
What's like most important to you in like, looking at the stories and like the protagonists and central figures? For example, like you talk about their age, being able to have that nostalgia factor, I think is really nice for me. Like when I wrote like for fun as a kid and everything, like fanfic, and they were always around that age because it makes you like think back. Like that's still a part of the process in some ways, I assume, for you.
Yeah, it is. Just like thinking about what was I like at that age? What would I have done? And also just the newness of the world to a child, to a young person. But the fact that like kids are dealing with some really tough situations all the time. It's never restricted to a single generation. So I try to be as like empathic as I can. Hayao Miyazaki is one of my biggest inspirations for this reason. He's never ever talks down to children. I think a lot of his films are to do with like, I'm just going to quote Gretchen Felker Martin, because like I wrote a tweet about how, sorry, I wrote a post on Blue Sky about how a lot of people misunderstand Miyazaki's films because they say, oh, Ghibli vibe, just cozy and cute. When really he's like grappling with his childhood, he's grappling, especially in his last two films, he's grappling about how he grew up in fascism.
Yeah.
He's grappling about how his father was a part of that system, whether he liked it or not. And he's grappling with how this kind of, but it also, because his father was, I think, the owner of like an airplane factory, it inspired Miyazaki's love for flight. That's a theme in all of his films, his love for flight. But he's kind of coming to terms with the guilt he feels maybe at being part of this, but also trying to reconcile it with like, well, this also, like, I love the concept of flying. And so I wrote this post, and Gretchen said that, you know, yeah, like people think about Ghibli films and Ghibli, quote unquote, Ghibli vibes as like rolling hills and a little guy who squeaks instead of the fact that, like, you know, fascism can poison even our most beautiful dreams. And I'm like, that's such a good way to sum up the theme of a lot of his movies. I specifically, like, all of his movies are in response to even Kiki's Delivery Service. It's inspired by what if, you know, World War II never happened. So he is writing and making these things in response to World War II and kind of the trauma that left on him, implicit, explicit, subconsciously, consciously. I think about that a lot. Like, his films are so beautiful aesthetically. They are, like, there's elements of it that are cozy and beautiful, but I think he's trying to show kids that the world can be beautiful, even though there's a lot of darknesses in these, like, fantasy worlds, right? There's a war going on in Howl's Moving Castle. The darkness of, like, the society in Spirited Away, where, like, someone can be cursed horribly, someone has to work off their debts in a bathhouse. There is an underlying darkness to all of his movies. This is not to mention, like, Mononoke and...
Right. He has films that are, like, more, like, straight-up political commentary that's very explicit. But even, like, Totoro, which everyone... I mean, that and Spirited Away, I think for the Western audience, those are just so iconic. But, like, Totoro dealing with, like, aspects of, like, terminal illness and dealing with family, getting sick, and how do you cope with that? So, in some ways, I think, like, having that aesthetic that is a little bit easier and maybe pleasing to people actually makes it easier to explore some really difficult themes. Like, that contrast is sometimes helpful, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially for children, it's easier for them to watch, but it's not that they're not being asked to think about these things. They are being asked to think about these things. I think all children's media is supposed to help them foster a sense of empathy or to help them process the world, and also, like, just to be enjoyable. Like, you know, children can enjoy things too. But yeah, so this is something I've been thinking a lot about recently, and about how I also want my work to speak to, you know, the darkness in children's lives, the darkness in, like, young adults' lives. God knows we're dealing with, like, enough of that right now.
Yeah.
In the world. Yeah, just stuff I've been thinking about. But Miyazaki, since I was a kid, has had such a big influence on me. As a child, it was aesthetically, wow, this is so beautiful. I want to be able to draw like this. I want to be able to create like this. But now, as an adult, an appreciation for the fact that he is speaking to children at their level, and he's being gentle with them, but he's also asking them to engage.
Right. The part about not talking down to them. But at the same time, there is, like, a respect for, like, what children have to deal with already in the modern world and modern society. So that there's also the, like, an adventure. Like, for example, like, here are some words that have been described for your work, which has been compared to Miyazaki, technically. So I will claim that for you. But there's, like, within, like, you know, heartbreak, loss, and, you know, dealing with familial bond, there's also, like, your stories involve a lot of adventure, a lot of magic, a lot of experiencing something meaningful for the first time. And that's juxtaposed with, like, grief and heartbreak and everything. So I feel like I can tell, you can see, like, the clear inspiration that you drew from, that's also from your childhood. And you infuse that into your work to this day, which I think is really lovely. Sometimes I think maybe people lose that a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah, I think some people, when they think, oh, I'm going to write for, like, children, when I'm going to write for young adults, and it's partially the creator, but also, like, a lot of it's to do with the publishing industry, thinking that it's okay to market things for that age group that are maybe, like, not of a higher artistic caliber, or, like, the same artistic caliber they would hold a piece for adults to. And I think that's a shame, because, like, some of my favorite authors wrote for both audiences, children and adults. I'm thinking specifically of Ursula Le Guin. Le Guin's Cat Wings books, I just bought them. They just were reissued, thankfully. It's just, like, the most beautiful little series about, like, cats with wings. And she lets it be kind of magical and special without trying to get into why do they have wings? In, like, an over-explaining scientific way. But Le Guin, but not just Cat Wings, which is just, like, a nice, gentle story for children, but to, like, also make them think about, you know, having empathy for animals, for, like, the non-human. But she writes, like, she wrote, like, The Dispossessed, which is one of my favorite novels of all time, which is about a man, a scientist who comes from essentially an anarchist society, and he goes into a capitalist society. And he, at first, he's really excited. He's like, oh, this is an opportunity for me to publish my papers. And then he ends up just like hating it, and he ends up having a meltdown. It's a really thoughtful, and the way she crafts the perspectives of like him trying to fit into this new place versus how he grew up and like the values he was raised with. It's just very, it's very interesting. Her, she is such a, she is so thoughtful. Like, I love her essays on craft as well. But she's also a children's author. Diana Wayne Jones is another one of my favorite children's authors. The OG of like Howl's Moving Castle. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the reason why Miyazaki had such a connection to her work is because she also grew up during World War II, and in a lot of her personal essays she talks about like how fucked up that was and about how that kind of influenced the way she writes for children. She has a lot of like really interesting essays as well. So I just think about all the work of all of these authors that I grew up with, you know, Eastern, Western, manga, prose, all of these authors, and the main lesson that I was taught was do not talk down to your audience.
Yeah.
Because they didn't talk down to me.
Yeah. And honestly, now that you mentioned that quality, I was like, yeah, I can think of some folks who have that effect on people. It feels like you're constantly being spoken down to, but you know, we won't name names, but well, so you started also like your quote unquote artistic journey career in like the webcomic world. How was it for you to like start there? And I remember, what is that now defunct online platform that people uploaded to, that world all the way to like publishing world? What's been your experience like?
I tried really hard to make a webcomic. I could not keep up with the updates. I think it was like Smack Jeeves was where I tried to upload my first webcomic. Was it Smack? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Smack, I'm thinking Jeeves. Of Smack Jeeves. Yep.
I tried so hard to like keep it consistent. Did not work out. That was like an attempt was made in college. And then Mooncakes, I also tried very hard to update, but without a deadline or like a solid structure. It was hard. And actually, we pitched Mooncakes as a book because my first pitch had just gotten rejected. So my agent was like, why not pitch Mooncakes? So we did. And that's how it became like a print book. That's how I started working in print books, period. Up until then, yeah, I had attempted to do some long form webcomics. I had done like, you know, a bunch of short form comics for my website, for my Tumblr audience. But yeah, that was my first foray into print. And, you know, it was super successful. Like, I'm so grateful for that. So as I was like drawing Mooncakes, people were telling me like, oh, you should try to write a middle grade. You know, you should try to write something that speaks to like a younger audience. And I was like, sure, why not? So that's how I pitched Tide Song. My very gracious editor at Harper, Alex, she bought Tide Song. As I was working on Tide Song, like the pitch, because I've always like I like to have things in my back pocket. I was like thinking about this story about like a robot romance, which I've always wanted to do. So we pitched The Infinity Particle a few months after. And instead of a 2-book deal, it became like a 3-book deal. It became a 3-book deal because initially the offer on Tide Song was for 2 books. It was for Tide Song and like just like another middle grade. Mm-hmm. But with Infinity Particle being YA, they were like, the next book can be like, you know, middle grade YA, like whatever. You have like space for one more project. So that was really cool. And that's how I was able to like quit my day job and just like start, you know, start working in books full time. I actually really like print as a medium. Because prior to this, like while I was working on Mooncakes, I had started experimenting with like printing my own little booklets and zines and stuff. And
yeah.
That was really valuable, like getting a lesson on trying to learn like trim size, you know, formatting for print, even how to like fold and staple them, I think is really important. Like I love DIY stuff. I love it so much. And I think I've been teaching like mini comics workshops for kids and for college students, and just how to like fold a little 8-page zine. They love it. And I think I love it too. It's so fun.
my God, I would take that actually.
Yeah.
Like I've been wanting to, like, I have some stories that are so like visual and I was always like, oh, I just want to do it. But like, I think there's that collaborative nature that makes like just writers nervous versus someone who's like you, who's sort of like multifaceted. But it's so fun to just, if no one else is going to do it, you should just do it. Like, yeah. Just try to make something out of it. And that's such a spirit that you have too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, if, you know, I think a lot of people are intimidated by a full comic, but you show them how fun and easy it is to make like an 8-page zine and suddenly like they just start making whatever they want. I think like that's like such a great first step to start making comics. And then you can show them how to do like a zine that's like bigger and how to like, you know, photocopy it and print it and staple it and stuff. And it's just like a good time.
Well, it's really heartwarming to hear that you still very much have that indie creator spirit despite like the commercial success that you so deserve and everything. But you're constantly talking about like, no, people should buy and support indie authors and people should learn how to create their own content and their own stuff. And you're able to comfortably like navigate both worlds, and I think that's really cool.
Thank you. I mean, a lot of this comes down to, we really can't rely on like big companies because they're always going to have their own financial interests at heart. So like at the end of the day, what do we have as artists? It's really easy to get comfortable, and like, you know, I am really grateful to be in the position I am, but as we've seen in the last year with all the social media shuffling, the Twitter, you know, acquired by that man who I will not name, it shows that like the creator economy online is so precarious, so tied to all these big tech companies. And so,
yeah.
So we owe it to ourselves to learn how to make our own websites, to make our own zines, to photocopy them, to distribute them. Physical media is like still really important. You know, I tell my students at the workshops that I was just teaching, you know, it's so easy to fold this up, unfold it, make a bunch of copies just for your friends if you want to. Like you can make 12 copies, you can make 20, and then you can fold them yourself and hand them out. And it's fun and empowering to be able to say, hey, look, I made this. And it's also just like a great way if you want to make a little zine on like health information. You know, I've seen zines on like body positivity and how to find, you know, an STI clinic even. Like those are all really, this is a really important skill to learn for the sake of like building a community as well. Yeah, I think a lot about how we can maintain, even in like print publishing, there's sometimes a push to pigeonhole yourself or to brand yourself, and you know, I'm a human. People are human beings, like they're not brands.
Yeah.
And brands are not people. I think art is inherently anti-capitalistic, right? We were drawing on cave walls before money was even invented. Like I think a lot about that. I think a lot about those paintings.
Yeah.
And how beautiful they were, and actually how they resemble comics. Mm-hmm. Yeah mm-hmm. They are, you know, that's comics. But I think about like the raw human drive to just make stuff and share it with other people. And like, that is such a beautiful part of who we are and how we are, of our humanity. And so it's really important to remember our humanity and to just make things for the sake of making them and to make things and share them with a smaller audience. I think ideally everyone would love to be a New York Times bestseller, if only for the financial stability that affords them. You know, I'm not gonna lie and say, oh, I'm above all of that. You know, I'm not above that. But in this industry, it's like, what do you have of yourself? Like, what do you want to keep for yourself? I don't want to give my whole self away.
Like, so what were some of the things that, as you were navigating the commercial world, especially when you knew you were like on the cusp of like commercial success, right? What were you reminding yourself of? Like, okay, Wendy, you're gonna like sign these contracts and everything, but make sure to hold on to these aspects of you. Like, what was that for you?
Okay, this is gonna sound so corny, but like, I have this memory of like, you know what? It's not corny. It's not corny because it's important to me. I have this memory of being in the basement with the person I wrote my first novel with and finishing writing it and being with this person and the love I felt for the book, the love I felt for my collaborator, just how excited I was to be able to have this project. at the time it wasn't conscious, but now I'm like, I never want to forget that feeling I had when I was 15.
Of like making the thing and experience making the thing.
Yeah. And falling in love with making the thing and falling in love with someone else. I think my love of art and my love of books, like writing books, and my love of the first time I fell in love are so emotionally connected that I cannot separate them in my heart. So that's my special little memory that I like pull out and look at whenever I feel like I'm losing track of what's important to me as a creator. And also just the other thing I remember is if I'm making something for myself, it can be as weird as I want. So I try to make things, like make little weird things sometimes. Maybe they don't all get finished, but that's okay. I try to touch grass. I love foraging. I think being in nature also is just like a really important way to remind yourself like we're part of something greater. I mean, I didn't start foraging till the pandemic. That's okay. It was like in between my, you know, my first book, Mooncakes, and my second book, Tide Song, but which was also like my solo first book. So,
you know what? I can see how foraging influenced. It seemed like you were exploring things because a lot of the stories, like it's very like connected to nature or like man's relationship to nature. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm thinking of like Mooncakes and Tide Song specifically, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think nature is cool. I read Entangled Life during the pandemic. I was like, wow, this is so cool. Fungi are so cool. Nature is so cool. I got like a planted fish tank that has shrimp in it. This little self-contained ecosystem. And I like to cook things. I like to connect with. I like to eat things too. Like I like to connect to other people by like cooking and eating and thinking about the ingredients. And I don't know, I'm like, wow, like this grew out of soil. Like that's really cool. You know, you take an onion, you're like, this is edible, and this grew from the ground.
Oh my gosh, you're so Studio Ghibli. I can, it's like, it like seeps out of you. Just like your natural spirit is so that aesthetic and like that way of looking at the world. Okay, I have a professional or like industry question for you. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you talk about collaboration. Mm-hmm. And like, this is a medium, the medium that you work in is like so collaborative in nature. What do you make like a good pairing or like a good collaborative effort? And what advice do you have for people who's like, wants to do projects, but they do need to find the right collaborators and they need to know how to like work together?
First of all, you have to get to know the medium because comics is not screenwriting. Comics is not film. Comics is not prose. Comics is comics. So read a lot of comics and just like love the medium. There's no point in trying to do something if you don't love, you know, what you're doing. Specifically for comics writers, try to draw. I see so many artists who are, you know, trying to write their own comics despite like maybe that's not their strong suit, but for the writers, they are just like, oh, I can't draw. And it's like, no, but you need to try. This is such a visual medium. You're never going to learn how a panel is laid out, the amount of words necessary to place in a speech balloon, how many actions can be taken within a span of a page. Like if you don't try to sketch it out yourself, it can be a stick figure. You don't have to show it to anybody. Give me the shittiest drawing on earth, but like you have to try to draw. You have to try to represent it visually. Otherwise, you can write all the scripts in the world, but you are not going to learn the nuances of the flow between panels, how characters move, how characters talk, how characters act, like unless you try to draw. You can draw stick figures, you can color one stick figure, you know, blue and the other one purple to represent two different characters. But like, I really encourage you to try. And also try, like, this is why I'm so like, you know, into DIY. It's really good for community building if you're just a writer starting out and you don't have a, you know, an artist collaborator. But showing that you try to draw, even if it's badly, that speaks so much more to an artist who you want to be a potential partner to rather than, you know, going to an AI art generator, which uses the stolen work of artists instead of saying, I can't draw, I'm going to use a shitty image generator. It speaks to the humanity of yourself. It speaks to your humility and it speaks to honoring the humanity of people you want to collaborate with. if you at least just try to draw.
Dang, that's so important. And that's so true. I'm not a drawer, but like you see behind me, I was told to put up pictures of composers. And for some reason, my ink had died. So I tried like drawing it and they're so terrible. But it was just a way for me to like engage with my body with something that I wanted to have in my life, if that makes sense.
I love
like,
it.
Something about actually drawing it. It was like, I don't know. It just felt like, oh, like I gave myself that experience rather than just printing it out of my printer. And it was just an accident because I couldn't do it that day. And I was like, fuck it, I'll draw it. And it was actually very empowering, even though, you know, again, not an expert or anything.
I think those are great. I love to see, you know, I think we need to have more space in society for quote unquote, like amateur art or bad art, because art is such a tactile process. For you,
yeah.
I teach middle and high schoolers, like I teach an after school art program. I have band tablets for the last 2 years. We are penciling and then we're taking it to a light box and doing our inks on the light box. If we fuck up on the light box, toss it out and get a new piece of paper. You're not going to learn how to become good at art if you can erase a single line over and over. And if you're just like tracing a 3D model, it's not how you get good. We get good by fucking up and we get good by life drawing. And so, like, we also get good by just making tons of bad art. Like, and it's fine. It's fine. There's no shortcut to becoming, I don't know. I don't know. I think of, like, what is spat out from AI art generators as this, like, kind of the lowest common denominator of what someone thinks is professional looking, what someone thinks is, quote, unquote, good. And it's, like, always, like, airbrushed and, like, highly rendered. And like sparkly, and you know, maybe it's painterly, but like those are not things that make a compelling piece of art. Like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to start a conversation? Are you trying to put out a piece of yourself? Or do you just want money? Do you just want money for something that you did not make? Because you're not gonna, like, they know they're not gonna get money, but if they sat down and drew a stick figure, they know that at most, like, people are gonna be like, oh, that's cool that you made that. But no, what they want is, like, they want money and clout. And that's why those people use these AR generators. I say art in quotes. Yeah. And that's just such a sad way to look at art. It's one of the, again, it's one of the most human things we can do. We just sit down and draw something, give that experience to our bodies, the connection between your brain, your hand, and like the pencil, the pen, and the paper, I think is just like so magical. I don't know. I love art.
Honestly, if you organize like some, like, you know how people do like drink and draw, or even just like the draw part, I would totally show up to, like, I have like specific like visual ideas, and I've never tried to actually be like, well, what would like a page of this important beat look like, because of like the embarrassment or the guilt or whatever, or also like because I was like by myself, which is not very motivating. But the more you talk about it, it's like a practice to like get it connected to your body, the same way that people work out, or like the way that I play piano. It like you have to be a little bit more present. And people talk about like good artists, it's also like why people love video games. You get to practice connecting your eyes, your brain, and your hands, which is so important.
And I'm always sketching people on the train with graphite. And I love graphite because you can just, I don't know, graphite is so forgiving to me, but I didn't know that I love graphite so much until I went back to doing more traditional media to kind of balance out how much digital art I have to do to be able to make my books. Yeah, there's something so inherently freeing about using graphite for me, about using like an architect pencil, a thick piece of graphite. I can't really explain, but I think it allows me to be imperfect in a way that I like. And I've done a lot of sketches that I haven't shown anyone, but I really like just drawing.
Yeah, it's just
train.
For you sometimes, yeah, it is, which is nice.
It is. So I highly encourage everyone to just draw.
Okay, so I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I have to end on something that's kind of like unhinged. It's just kind
of
silly.
Of course.
Because we're in such weird times. Okay, YA, you know, BookTube, BookTok, it's like so big these days, and there's so much discourse around it. And I know you're kind of, you know, some of the recent things that have happened. And what do you think of the critique of YA genre, despite it being such like a commercial heavy hitter, like it needs... like the publishing world relies on that genre so much for actual sales, but then they also talk about like what's it, like fast publishing now or whatever, or like people are critiquing like quality. I don't know. Do you have any like general thoughts or reflections around that?
Yeah, I think everyone is overworked. I think that authors can't do their best work if they're being encouraged to just like push it out as fast as possible. I think editors are all really stressed. Design teams, very stressed. This is also that what you can potentially have a heavy hitter that puts money in a CEO's pocket. I think it's very hard to tell people these days that, you know, obviously we should all be caring about money and about our bills. But I would also just really like to tell people it's okay to take your time. You know, it's okay to take your time on a book. They're not going to cancel your book deal if you can't put it out as fast as humanly possible. It's okay to take extra time to work on your craft. I would rather people work on their craft than make book talk videos. Let me tell you that. That's just my... Like, I understand we all have to do promotion and stuff. Like, I'm not necessarily blaming people, but when you are spending time like recapping book drama instead of working on your craft, that says something about you that, you know, I don't support that. I don't fuck with that. I also think, like, I know you mentioned before we started recording about like the recent book talk, like the blow up. I think it is so disgusting that it got national media coverage. When we are in an unprecedented human rights crisis right now, like the worst human rights crisis of our lifetimes, and like, why is this getting like, what the hell? This is not national newsworthy. I'm sorry. Like, it's just not.
Yeah. Authors have been dropped for a variety of reasons since the history of publishing. So it's interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Like, I mean, she, you know, this person has suffered enough professional consequences. Can we move on now? Why did it have to make NBC? I'm sorry, like the NBC thing, I was like, why is this on NBC? I'm sorry. Like, I think it's just, it's a horrible distraction. I think we should just put our thought into things that matter. Like, I'm sorry, at the end of the day, we're not working the ER. It's just books, you know? It's just books. I know that, like, as a debut, people can feel very excited and very nervous, but it's, like, as someone who's, like, 3 books into a career, like, not everything's gonna be a commercial hit. Now, you're not gonna get on the best of list every year. You're not gonna get, hell, you're not even gonna get, like, nice Goodreads reviews. I don't look at mine. I don't ever look at those.
I presume authors don't do that for their own, like, health it and
just,
benefit.
Like, yeah, like for psychic, and I'm not saying this to be holier than thou, but like I simply choose to spend my energy on my craft and looking at art and thinking about other things that are not like, how is this doing on Goodreads? Right. Or like, what do people think? Like, you can't control what people think. You can just, the only thing you can do is just like work on your craft.
What do you think of the, because this has been brought up again because of the recent controversy that we're referring to. So you're a queer woman of color in like the YA publishing world. Do you think it's easier to quote unquote find commercial success because of your marginalized identity, let's say?
Oh my God. Not really. I think it's, I think what's really easy is to pigeonhole yourself and to say yes to the labels that you're assigned. And maybe for some, it's easier to capitalize on that. Identity is such a fraught thing. Identity is such a personal thing. And also for me, the act of writing a book is like almost, again, a sacred thing because of my personal experience. I don't know what, I can't speak to other people's experiences and what brought them to this industry, what brought them to their love of it. But I can only speak for me and to say that my love of writing stories is just tied to my love for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not that I don't care about commercial success. I would like to keep getting money to do what I do, right, obviously. But I always try to think about, like, I just try to think about what it means to me. And like, I try to have fun with it. I have a hard time having fun with it because I am a perfectionist. That's like one of my flaws. So maybe I've become too focused on the craft and I'm like, you know, dragging my feet a little bit on my next book. Sorry to my editor, Alex. Shout out to Alex for her patience. Shout out to my agent, Linda, for her patience. Like, shout out to the whole team for their patience. But I mean, I think that commercial success, if it finds you, it finds you. If it doesn't, there's really nothing you can do about it, sadly.
Yeah, and you didn't fall, like, your love of everything you're doing now did not begin because of commercial success, which, you know, that's not a thing that would happen very often. But that's so true, though, that it's not like people use these things that we care about strategically for this thing that may or may not happen. So it's like interesting where you just say, like, I just want to focus on the craft and also like my love for humanity in some ways is what I hear.
Yeah, I think that like, for example, I think Mooncakes, I want to think that Mooncakes was so, part of why it was so successful is because it came from the heart, you know? It came from just me and Suzanne wanting to keep our friendship alive because she moved to Chicago. But also, like, yes, shout out to Cindy Barwick at Lionforge at the time. Cindy, who was the most amazing marketing person, and she was the VP of marketing, and, you know, had an amazing campaign for Mooncakes Promotions. A lot of it is to do with Cindy and how much she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, commercial success, it's arbitrary. I feel like as long as I keep getting paid to, like, make books, like, that's good enough for me, and right. Like to do like school visits and stuff like that, that's good enough for me, I think.
You're so pure.
Oh my god, stop. No, I'm not. I mean, like, it's, oh my god, it's not like I don't get, like, you know, jealous, or it's, but also, like, you know what else is inspiring? Yowie. just like seeing, like, the passion people put into these stories, like these fan novels. I'm just like, I appreciate it. I read a yaoi about, like, by a Japanese author about, like, a New England doctor who falls in love with a med student. I'm like, she was writing outside of, like, her cultural range. I'm like, but wow, like, I love this. It totally makes me believe, like, you know.
Oh my god. No, it's true, though. Like, sometimes you gotta find something that's just purely just, like, here's someone who just enjoys doing this thing because they're doing it because they enjoy it. And it's, like, a little, like, recharge for, like, I don't know, inspiration, or you're feeling, like, stuck or something. And I totally feel that way, too.
Yeah.
Now you're making me want to breed yaoi.
I think the girls who draw yaoi are the strongest people on the planet.
Shout out to the laborers in the yaoi industry, y'all.
Like, shout out to everyone who draws yaoi. Incredible work, everybody. Like, yeah. A+.
Keep it up. You have dedicated loyalists. I certainly.
I mean, but also, sorry, on like a slightly sadder note, but like the Chinese fujoshis, you know, the girls who really love yaoi, they do risk like jail time if they're caught with this stuff sometimes.
Oh yeah.
So it's like, you love this so much, you are willing to risk it all, you know, like for a genre that you love, for something that you love. I think that's really powerful.
Thank you for bringing that up, because not all of us are in New York, New York. And different places have very different context for what it takes to actually even be an artist to do what we want. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's so true. Truly shout out to people putting their work out there. And I'm so glad you brought up so many authors and names and folks that you know who are in this world, because we're all just sort of like doing our best, right? You're someone where, like, having known you from, like, quote unquote, way back when, it's been, like, so nice to see your trajectory. And in many ways, dare I say, like, it's inspiring to see people who can navigate it and still have, like, a strong sense of self and can, like, eat, you know, put food on the table. Like, what more can you ask for? It's really nice seeing you like
this. Oh, thank you. I try. I have really good friends. I have really good friends, you included. You know, I have such good people in my life to keep me grounded. I've definitely had moments where I've gotten too in my head, and, you know, my friends who are in this industry have, like, you know, we've talked about it. They've talked me down, and, like, I really appreciate all of them who have just repeated to me, you know, focus on the craft. It's okay. Just focus on the craft.
Right, so. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, so for anyone who's sort of being introduced to you, where can they find you and more stuff about you? And then, like, you know, what would be like an upcoming release that they can look forward to?
Oh, okay. So I'm mostly on Instagram these days as Art of Wendy Shu. I am also on Blue Sky as Wendy Shu. My website is artofwendyshu.com. It needs to be updated. but those are the main places you can find me. And as for, I am working on another book. I kind of don't want to talk too much about it. Okay. I want it to be a surprise. So, but it is coming. It involves fox spirits. There's a queer love story, but it's rather toxic. Let's just put it that way.
Just the fact that it involves like fox spirits is already so Asian. Or as Ari liked to say, I was like rereading Mooncakes today to prep for this conversation. And Ari just goes, yeah, it's really queer and it's really Asian. I love it. And I was like, that pretty much sums up Mooncakes in many ways. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope, yeah. I this one is also, I think, really queer and like specifically Chinese. I did a lot of, so to prep for this book, I took a Chinese literature, pre-modern Chinese literature class this fall. So there's like so much good stuff that I have now thought about, including Yaoi. Shout out to my teacher, Brendan, who is also a friend and who had to deal with me typing like Yaoi in the YouTube sidebar every time he live streamed and we were talking about like the reading for the day. I was like...
Where you were like, did you know there are historical yaoi?
Yeah, I know. I was like, wow, this is a historical yaoi. Wow, the interpretation, this can be interpreted as a yaoi. I was like rather unhinged. So, you know, thank you for putting up with me, Brendan.
Well, people definitely will have that to look forward to whenever we will be privileged to see it. Folks should just look up her Instagram and her website and see the list of her published works. They're all amazing. I have some sitting right here. And yeah, just go explore. Alongside, also, Wendy has free comics, accessible comics that are available online. And yeah, so all are welcome.
Yes.
Thank you for your time today, Wendy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.